It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last month, Pope Leo delivered a major statement on the explosion of artificial intelligence technology and its ethical challenges.
He called for more government regulation of AI corporations, protections for workers whose jobs are threatened, and for more protection for children. Vice President J.D. Vance echoed some of the Pope's sentiments in a speech to the U.S. Air Force Academy.
And if the warfare of the future is to live up to the moral values of our ancestors, decisions over life and death must be made by humans and not machines.
The Pope's address comes as AI is a multi-trillion dollar industry and as communities around Wisconsin grapple with the boom in data centers that drive the technology.
Robin Zabrowski has been following the rise of artificial intelligence and the concerns surrounding the technology. Robin's a professor of cognitive science, a department chair of cognitive science at Beloit College. Robin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we had Pope Leo addressing the world earlier this month, warning about exploitation through AI, what he called a culture of power surrounding the technology, talking about the impact on kids and a lot more. Hearing that, I thought, well, what does Robin think about that? Because we've been talking about the progress of AI so much over the years. What are your thoughts on the Pope's message on this technology?
Oh, so many thoughts. I was really hesitant to read it. At first I was like, really, does the Pope need to chime in? And then as I thought about what's going on in the world, I said, no, I think that's probably appropriate. And so when I read it, I was very pleasantly surprised by a lot of the nuance. I think there are a couple of places that maybe I don't think he gets it quite right, but for the majority of it, I mean, I think he's focusing on the right things, the repeated focus on the social doctrine and things like that. Yeah, we can definitely talk specifics, but I think he mostly gets it.
Before we dig into some specifics, you've clarified in the past, when we say AI, we're talking about a lot of stuff. Can you distinguish some of the main technologies that people might interact with or hear about and how the categories can blur a little bit?
When we talk in the media about AI, we're largely talking about the large language models, which is things like Copilot and Gemini and ChatGPT and all of those things that have really sort of taken over the world of AI. But in the AI community, when we talk about AI, we talk about the things that preceded those large language models too, which are also still happening in parallel, things like facial recognition technology and machine learning algorithms that do a whole lot of work in medicine, for example. So there's lots and lots of different AI systems. But most of what we tend to mean is large language models these days.
In the world of ethics and morality, as the Pope is addressing this from, and I think maybe in general, there's a concern that, hey, we're adapting these new technologies a lot, especially those large language models, without necessarily thinking through the consequences and the impacts. Do you think it's worthwhile, whether we're talking about the Pope or whether we're talking about a state legislature or the public in general, slowing down and thinking more about the consequences of adapting this technology so quickly?
100% yes. It's really funny because people have been doing AI ethics for at least 25 years. When I was in grad school in the late 90s, I had a colleague working on AI ethics and everyone was like, what are you even doing? That's not really a thing. And so we've had people focusing on this for their careers, warning us in advance. And the problem, or at least part of the problem, is that nobody reads philosophers. So a lot of this conversation has in fact happened for many years. But I also think that there were ways that large language models happened that we hadn't fully anticipated. And the ethical impacts are, there's so many different ones. Like we could talk for an hour on like 15 different dimensions of the ethical issues. And so, yes, I think slowing down is absolutely the first right step.
Large language models, let's focus in on them. Ethical issues there. What would be number one on your list? Before I start randomly throwing them at you, what is your biggest, hey, slow down moment?
I think there are so many that it's hard to pick just one, but I think the ways it's being pushed into schools and workplaces is probably the worst aspect of it right now, especially in schools. And that is a thing I think the Pope kind of gets right in the encyclical where he says, you know, education has a role to play and we ought to be not necessarily pushing these systems that don't have access to truth, that have no way of checking for truth. Like there's all sorts of ways in which education is not the right place for large language models. So I think I would say that's probably my number one.
Yeah, children today are going to be the first generation to grow up with AI widely available. And as we mentioned, the Pope talked about protecting children from potential harms. When it comes to using it, now, one concern is people using AI to create child sexual abuse images and things like that, which is a thing that's happening. But you're concerned about more than that, it sounds like. You're concerned about kids using AI and normalizing kids using these large language models as part of their education. Why?
So as a cognitive science, I know a little bit about how learning works. And that's not to say that I know everything, because we still don't fundamentally understand the nature of learning in the human brain. But the way large language models work is because they give you this fast answer. First of all, they lower motivation. There are now, thankfully, a bunch of studies done that show that students, young students especially, who are given these models and use them, at first, they get the answers quicker, and sometimes they get the answers correct. And so it lowers their motivation to ever seek out the answers on their own. And I don't know how you get academics if nobody's interested in seeking out answers on their own. Like, the whole nature of expertise feels like it's going to go by the wayside. So that's a huge problem. But so is the way that the models are sycophantic, right? They always tell you what you want to hear. You correct them and they're like, oh, you're so right. I'm so sorry. I got that wrong. And it's leading now to suicides and psychosis. It's now officially called AI psychosis. It's made it into medical journals. It's really worrisome. I mean, you have a single kid who's maybe using a large language model as a friend instead of confiding in a person, and you could miss the signs of suicidal ideation. And we already know that something like 30 people have lost their lives in which large language models are at the very least heavily implicated.
Now, how about at the workplace? Another point of concern. Companies are looking at this and saying, hey, we can have these large language models do some of our grunt work, right? These reports that take a lot of time to assemble, we could have it at least write the first draft or help edit the work somebody's doing. Why is that different than other tools? Why would that be a point of concern?
Yeah, so it depends on the use, to be honest. I've been concerned. So every time I go to the doctor now, there's signs in the rooms that say things like, AI might be listening. Please let us know if you're not okay with that. You can imagine I'm very quickly like, hey, I'm not okay with that. But when generative AI, which are usually things like the large language models, are used in ways like that, they're supposed to be used to sort of take the work off doctors so that your doctor doesn't have to write everything down in real time. We already had really good transcription technology that could do that, that didn't invent things that weren't said. So with those models, we're seeing reports now that they're inventing things, they're inventing symptoms that people didn't report, and they're showing up in those summaries. It's really quite dangerous in medicine. We're also seeing de-skilling, massive de-skilling. So I know that it's talked a lot about in computer science, right, that we have the experts and that usually we get new graduates just out of school who we hire into computer science to do the low-level coding, and they get better and better over time, and then they end up in those high levels. But if we're offloading that work to large language models, especially things like Claude, then we're not hiring those students right out of school, and we're not cultivating that pipeline to get to those higher levels, and we're just going to lose those skills entirely. And it is not at all clear that the AI coding is actually better or even as good as human coding. So there's just such a wide range of potential problems of using these in work settings, depending on what that work is.
Now, if you look at Wisconsin headlines, the biggest intersection, I think, with AI is the data centers that power these large language models. Some communities pushing back, in some cases canceling planned development programs. How do you think people should be weighing the benefits of something like that coming to their community versus the environmental costs and other costs of having these things in place?
Yeah, it's a great question. I live in Rockford right now, and they're pondering a data center here. And I work in Beloit, and in Beloit, they have, in the town of Beloit and in the city, they've been proposing them. And the citizens are turning out in all of these cases, which I think is really fantastic. It really shows that people don't want these data centers in their communities, which I mean, I hope that our elected officials are going to listen, but they're really not great, and it's not at all clear what we need them for. So right now, companies are starting to dial back their investments in AI because they're learning that AI is actually more expensive than it is to hire the humans to do that work in a whole bunch of cases. I mean, we know about the environmental impacts. They're really bad for communities, for pollution, for water usage, for electricity usage. I know, where is it? Lake Tahoe was just getting headlines because their utility has said, we can no longer provide power to the people that live here because we need to provide power to the data center. So those people are now sitting there without a utility to service their homes. Data centers, I think there is unquestioningly nothing about them that outweighs the harm. I think all of our communities should be coming out to resist them being put in place.
Robin, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Robin Zabrowski is a professor of cognitive science and department chair of cognitive science at Beloit College. Been talking about artificial intelligence, large language models, and concerns about its rapid adoption. Now we'll look at the ways public policy and the law are trying to deal with the rising technology. Ben Sobel is an assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, we've talked some about these concerns that people might have with the adoption of AI and large language models. It seems like this is a technology that's moving so quickly, it can be tough for public policy and the legal framework to keep up. Are there areas where you see some consensus building around either ways to regulate and issue new regulations or figure out how existing law can regulate artificial intelligence?
Gosh, you know, it might be premature for me to say that there's consensus emerging. I will identify a few places where there does seem to be concerted action. So when it comes, for example, to responding to the problem of non-consensual intimate deepfakes, so AI-generated realistic images that might depict people in the nude, for example, we've seen responses at the state level, widespread responses in state legislation, as well as a federal statute that addresses the problem. In addition, we're seeing lawsuits playing out in court dealing with the unauthorized use of copyrighted materials to train AI. And while those decisions have been slow in coming, we're seeing a few of them emerging. And I wouldn't say that there's consensus yet, but we're starting to get the lay of the land when it comes to those copyright issues as well.
And copyright, you've written about that very issue. And this is a concern. Okay, I can ask a large language model to write me a country music song about puppies if I want, and it writes a new song. But then the artists whose work those models have been trained on, what is the state of the art right now if they own a piece of that, if they have legal recourse, if their material is used to train those programs without their consent? Where are the creators in this right now legally?
Yeah, I would say that they're in a difficult position. So copyright has a concept called the fair use doctrine that excuses some unauthorized, uncompensated uses of copyrighted materials, particularly if they're in service of what the law calls a transformative purpose. And so some examples, you know, might be news reporting or internet search, image search, things like that. And so there have been two really big decisions from the past year. They're about a year old, both from California, and they both found that AI training was highly transformative, but they differed quite a bit in how they ultimately thought the fair use defense was going to fare. And in fact, two judges in the very same courthouse deciding pretty similar cases within days of each other came down in really, I would say, different analytical directions when it comes to how to think of the potential harm that AI-generated works might cause to the markets for the creators whose works trained that AI. So one court was much more receptive to an argument that unfortunately the plaintiffs in that case didn't make, that the output of generative AI might actually end up diluting the market, harming the market for the works that trained it, whereas another judge was less receptive to that argument. So I would say that there's still a fair amount of figuring out to be done before we can say that we've got a real consensus on the matter.
A thing people might be concerned about is, hey, we've been putting our pictures online for years, pictures of our kids. Our medical appointments, as we heard, might be transcribed with an AI program. what kind of rights do we have over our data to make sure it isn't used in ways that can market things to us, harm us in some way, be used in commercial ways that we don't approve of? Do we have rights? Is it clear whether we have rights to our own data as it's used by these large language models?
Yeah, by and large, you know, your rights may be pretty limited. So there are going to be specific privacy policies and terms of service that are going to govern things on a fact-specific basis. Certainly as far as copyright is concerned, you know, many people may be surprised to know the sort of limits of that entitlement. And similarly, you know, there's no sort of general right to control your likeness or to stop other people from depicting you. It's not sort of a general entitlement. There may be some cases where existing law could step in. And so we're seeing efforts from Congress, from state legislatures to work towards filling what they see as a gap in that coverage. But as it stands, I would not say that protections against data use are particularly robust.
As somebody who's trading the Wisconsin lawyers of the future, is AI basically part, the law around AI part of the curriculum now?
Well, I'll tell you this. I lay down the law when it comes to AI in my classroom, and I do so in a way that might surprise some of your listeners, which is that I, you know, have a ban on laptops and electronic devices in class. And I think that that's because in you know, my personal experience and I think common sense, I've seen students get distracted, whether they're using those devices themselves or simply in the room with other people using those devices. I think that learning is something that you can't delegate. And so I try my best to ensure that students are processing the information, participating in class discussions on their own, and really engaged in the moment, in the class discussion. And so for that reason, I forbid them from using AI in class. But that's not to say it can't be a useful tool. And so I think that, of course, striking the right balance, encouraging lawyers, aspiring lawyers, and indeed practicing lawyers, to use the tool responsibly is important as well. And so that involves careful awareness that these tools can hallucinate citations. They can refer to cases or materials that don't exist. They can get facts wrong. But they may also be useful tools for running really broad queries, nailing down a particular type of question or pointing to legal authorities that a lawyer can then follow up with and verify. So, you know, I try not to be categorical in condemning or endorsing. It's all contextual. But in the context of my classroom, I don't condone AI use because I think that students learn better when they are focused and present.
Ben, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Ben Sobel is an assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We've been talking about artificial intelligence and the legal and public policy concerns around the technology. We also heard about the moral and ethical concerns with Robin Zabrowski, Beloit College Department Chair for Cognitive Science. Well, is this technology part of your life? Do you use some kind of chatbot or agent or other so-called AI technology in your work, your school, for fun? Love to hear what you are doing with it, what you would refuse to use it for. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.